In early October, one of Haiti's largest companies made a startling announcement. Due to insufficient supplies, it could no longer produce water. Without clean water, the country soon became victim to an outbreak of cholera. And although the disease is both preventable and treatable, Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, population nearly 1 million, was down to just 3 working ambulances. Yet, neither a lack of clean water, a deadly outbreak of cholera, nor even an acute shortage of medical care topped the list of Haiti's most pressing challenges. These are merely 3 symptoms of a much bigger problem, a chronic fuel shortage, causing prices to climb as high as $50 a gallon. Without fuel, ambulances couldn't respond to emergencies, children couldn't get to school, and electricity was unavailable even to homes fortunate enough to have it. Many companies couldn't even pay their workers, effectively pressing pause on civilization. The fuel shortage was caused by the blockade of a storage site responsible for 70% of the nation's oil by an armed coalition of gangs. The same gangs who regularly terrorize the population, carrying out violence in broad daylight, often in view of police. Unfortunately, this is nothing new. In Haiti, it's often difficult to discern where one crisis ends and another begins. Articles from years past could almost be reprinted word for word today. This one from 2019 perfectly describes the most recent crisis. And these two, written over a decade apart, sound eerily similar. Stories of one or another disaster in Haiti have become an almost routine feature of the news cycle, along with North Korean missile tests and Facebook privacy scandals. Just last year, it was hit with a magnitude 7.2 earthquake, killing thousands and doing 10% of the entire national GDP in damage. Haiti's president was assassinated just 38 days earlier. And only 67 miles away from this most recent earthquake was the epicenter of another in 2010. That one killed at least 160,000 people and destroyed some of its most historic buildings. The result has been decades of economic stagnation. This is the average GDP in the Latin America and Caribbean region, its neighbors. These are all low-income countries. And this, meanwhile, is Haiti. 40% of the population, 4.4 million people, need urgent humanitarian assistance. Now, there's no doubt geography plays a role. The island sits in an earthquake hotspot within a hotspot, and hurricanes are a fact of life. The data is unambiguous. Natural disasters occur more frequently, do more damage, and are more fatal in Haiti compared to its neighbors. But what all these things have in common, from its inability to recover from natural disasters to the fact that gangs can effectively hijack the entire country, is a lack of state capacity. The government is weak, overwhelmed, and frequently short-lived. In the 3.5 decades between 1986 and 2021, for instance, the average president served for just 1 year and 11 months. In that time, only 2 served their full 5-year terms. One lasted just 3 days, and 7 of these 19 presidents held office for less than a year. Political instability is, by far, the country's number one barrier to development. The question is, if political instability is the root of Haiti's problems, what's the root of this instability? Sponsored by CuriosityStream and Nebula. For a limited time, right now for the holidays, you can get both for an amazing $11.59 a year, and start watching my exclusive series, China Actually. When the 13 colonies declared independence in 1776, the United States was overshadowed economically by one of its tiny southern neighbors, Haiti. Then a French colony, Haiti was the source of 75% of the world's sugar and half of its coffee, despite being roughly the size of Massachusetts. It was, in fact, the richest colony in the New World. Though, of course, this immense wealth did not reach the almost million slaves, who at one point or another were brought there. But what many of their French colonizers didn't realize is that many of these slaves were former soldiers, captured in battle throughout Central Africa. And when the French Revolution reached the shores of Haiti in 1791, they rose up, declaring the first independent Caribbean state and first free black republic. To symbolize this, the republic's first flag was based on France's, with a white stripe removed. There was, however, one major problem. A bit of small print that would haunt the country for centuries to come. Although Haiti had triumphed in battle against the French, Spanish, English, and even Napoleon himself, there was one thing it still needed: recognition. For France, losing control of its most profitable colony was a national embarrassment. For years, it refused even to speak the name Haiti, pretending as if nothing ever happened. But without recognition, Haiti was effectively stuck in limbo, unable to sign treaties, send diplomats, or feel secure in its sovereignty. So, having exhausted all other options, Haiti's president made a suggestion. What if it could simply pay? For years, the two countries negotiated back and forth until one day France decided enough was enough. Haiti would owe it 112 million francs, about 560 million in today's dollars. French goods would be subject to only half the standard tariffs. And in return, it would finally recognize the country's existence. But this time, it wasn't asking. If Haiti refused, it threatened to bombard the capital with cannon fire. Haiti had no choice. While many empires have been called on to pay reparations, only in Haiti did slaves pay their former masters, forced essentially to buy their own bodies. France didn't just steal much-needed resources from this newly independent republic, resources it used to build the Eiffel Tower. It also trapped the country in a payday loan-like cycle of debt. It had no choice but to take on more and more loans, often with predatory interest rates and fees. In 1838, half of Haiti's annual budget was spent on the military, less than 1% on education, and about 30% servicing its national debt. By the turn of the century, that 30% had become 50%. And in 1914, a staggering 80%. It's been estimated that without this debt, the nation's per capita income might be 6 times higher today. And yet, even this steep sacrifice did not earn Haiti a seat at the international table. More than 50 years after it declared independence, two important powers still refused to recognize it: the Vatican and the United States. To do so, places like America and Britain thought, might inspire similar revolts among slaves at home. Only in 1862, after southern states left the Union, did the US officially recognize it. Little did Haiti know, American involvement would soon become much more a curse than a blessing. Between 1870 and 1905, the share of U.S. imports to Haiti nearly doubled, from less than 40% to over 70%. The former French colony effectively freed itself from the grips of one empire, only to replace it with another. And this new one was no less greedy. From Washington's point of view, Haiti was becoming far too dominated by German merchants, who weren't afraid to use their wealth to support revolution. On the eve of World War I, Americans weren't too keen on inviting the Germans into their backyard. They also had an interest in opening up Haiti's economy, which, as a safeguard against a return to slavery, was largely off-limits to foreigners. In reality, the Germans likely had no intention of taking over Haiti. But it didn't matter. The United States saw its golden opportunity to kill two birds with one stone: to drive out the Germans while converting a perennial source of instability just 600 miles from Florida into an obedient client state. The US government at the time didn't actually know much about Haiti, but it soon found an ally more than happy to fill its vacuum of knowledge: Wall Street. To American corporations, Haiti represented a giant untapped market, if only it were stable. The only thing that could stabilize it, they decided, was US occupation. And the only thing that could compel a US occupation was an acute crisis. So they set out to create one. The National City Bank of New York, now known as Citibank, set its plan in motion by purchasing a majority stake in a Haitian bank. But not just any ordinary bank. As a private for-profit French corporation, it could simply be bought. But it also just so happened to serve as Haiti's national treasury, with a monopoly on printing currency, holding tax revenue, and even commercial lending. Services it provided to the government for a fee. Whoever owned it, in other words, effectively owned Haiti. All the Americans had to do to get what they wanted was withhold the government's money, or just outright steal it. And that's exactly what they did. Their opportunity came after another investor, James McDonald, promised to build a railway connecting two of Haiti's largest cities. In exchange, he was granted the rights to 12 miles of land on each side of the tracks, where he planned on building banana plantations. To locals, this sounded suspiciously like a return to the exact kind of foreign-owned export economy the country was founded to prevent. These alarm bells led to an uprising, and seven presidents came and went in a matter of just 4 years. Although this was far from the most violence Haiti had ever seen, this time American property was at risk, providing the perfect pretext for an invasion. In 1914, US Marines landed in Port-au-Prince, stole millions of dollars in gold from the National Treasury, and sailed away as if they hadn't just committed 17th century armed piracy. A year later, they returned. This time, they stayed for nearly two decades, during which the US installed a puppet government, declared martial law, and re-established a form of forced labor. Beating out the French for the title of Haiti's biggest villain was a near impossible task, but the Americans somehow managed. Far from stabilizing the country, laying the groundwork for rapid economic development, as intended, US involvement had an unexpected consequence. Not only did it centralize power and help normalize political violence, but it also undermined the government's legitimacy. How could Haitians see their leaders as being legitimate when they answered first to Washington? Now, to be clear, the Haitian government has historically been just as much a perpetrator as a victim of this broken system. Corruption is rampant and violence, at best, tolerated, and all too often, outright state-sponsored. Nobody, in or outside of Haiti, trusts its government. And for good reason. But this creates its own problems. Take, for example, the devastating 2010 earthquake. Unlike most foreign natural disasters, it not only captured but sustained the world's attention. Millions donated to relief efforts, and $2.29 billion in aid was promised in total. Suddenly, Haiti was being overwhelmed with money, and for once, genuine goodwill. The only question was where to put it. When the earthquake struck, the government of Haiti was so weak that UN peacekeepers were already in the country on a different mission. It not only wiped out virtually every public building, but also the very UN building which would have provided earthquake relief. Just 1% of humanitarian aid and 23% of recovery funds between 2010 and 2011 were directed to the government. Instead, nearly every last penny went, as it always does in Haiti, to NGOs. And as more and more money bypasses the government, it becomes weaker and weaker, ensuring the next crisis is even deadlier. It's clear that Haiti will never escape this cycle until it has strong, capable, and competent leadership. But it's also become abundantly clear that foreign intervention is more likely to aggravate than relieve Haiti's suffering. That, although the source of its challenges may be foreign, the cure can't be. that although geography may predispose the country to frequent natural disasters, the Haiti of 2022 was far from predetermined. Natural explanations for Haiti's struggles are simply an excuse for centuries of abuse by foreign powers. The same storm, after all, can be catastrophic in one place and only mildly inconvenient in another. And the scientific reasons for that are actually quite interesting. This weekend, I'm watching Countdown to a Catastrophe, Storms, on today's sponsor, CuriosityStream, home to thousands of great documentaries on history, science, and nature. Right now, for a limited time during the holidays, you can get CuriosityStream and Nebula together 42% off for just $11.59 a year. On Nebula, you can watch my exclusive original series, China Actually, including the episode I just released last week explaining why China has a surprisingly responsible nuclear posture and why that matters. At less than a dollar a month for two streaming platforms, you won't find a better deal. Click the link on screen right now to get both Nebula and CuriosityStream and start watching today.